Hello, hello again, everyone, and welcome. This is Julie Knutson with episode number 67 of Training the Pointing Labrador. And I've been, I haven't been doing the podcast the last couple weeks, and I apologize for that. It's hunt test season, and people and dogs are on a high press to get done. And then I've got my own event I've been training on for the past months that's coming up this weekend. So it's just been a little bit hectic. So I apologize for that. I'm going to try and get in some listener questions that I've had over the past few months and see if I can help the people that have kind of probably been waiting and haven't gotten some of their questions answered. So I'm going to jump right into this. But just before I get going, in case there's anyone new or listening to the podcast for the first time, this is just a podcast about retriever training. Also emphasis on retrievers at point and very conventional retriever training as well. The training, the ownership, the taking personal responsibility for learning about it and doing the very best you can. If you're looking to get better or just to learn how to do this, it can be so very confusing. I mean, there is so much out there and so much information, and you hear one thing and it sounds so common sense and so reasonable, and then the next time you look, you hear almost exactly the opposite thing. No, the thing you must do is, and it can be real confusing. So I've been doing this for a long time, and with, you know, all the success that I ever wanted out of it, and I just offer to my own clients and to people that are interested. It, just a way of thinking about this so that you can sort of find your own way through this and the things that are best for you to do. So that's what this whole podcast is about. And I sometimes it's just retriever stuff, and sometimes it's just dog stuff, and sometimes it's pointing stuff. And I know there's people out there from all around and all different kinds of interests. So I try as often as I can to, you know, meet the needs of as many people as I possibly can. But on this one today, I'm going to try and address questions that I've gotten so I don't leave anybody behind. And one is a message that I got, and I'm going to just read a little bit of it so that you can see exactly. It's a long message. I'm just going to give the relevant parts. And it's, hi, Julie, I have a question about developing point. My puppy is about 9 months old, and we're following along with your book with success. And then they go into all the different stuff they're doing. They're currently working through, they've done obedience and force fetch and collar conditioning. And so they're getting up there doing things in a good time frame. And so the question, he says, anyway, my question is, how do you put the dog in a position to learn he can't catch the bird and the best approach is to stop and point? As of right now, if he can see the bird, he just runs in and tries to catch it. Yeah, they all do that. If there is an obstruction between him and the bird, which he can smell but not see, he'll stand like a statue. I've been trying not to intervene all the while in the upland field, but more often than not, he is on a dead sprint 50 yards away, busting birds as soon as he gets in the scent cone. Is this something that needs to be developed over time and repetition? And should I mix in shot birds to maintain interest, pointed or non? I know he's a puppy and things take time to develop, but I just want to make sure I'm giving him a chance to develop and not eroding his natural pointing tendencies with too much dependent training. Okay, that's a really good question. And I would say probably 80% of everybody else out there that's trying to do this with their pointing dogs has the same thing. And I'm kind of chuckling because I, you know, it's very frustrating. You know, you buy this pointing lab and you do everything right, and they go out there and they show you some point, right? And you get real excited, and then they become the heat-seeking missile. And it's frustrating, and everybody's throwing up their hands, you know. And so then you look to some of those methods where you tie the rope around them and all kinds of stuff. So one, this is very, very normal. Because if you think about it, at first, you do want a dog who is very, very birdy. I mean, they need to really, really like birds and really have a lot of interest. Now, there are some dogs, I've had some in training, you know, that point and hold and they just hold. And it's awesome. It's just great. And you don't have to do anything and they just have that pointer thing pretty strong. And then you have dogs that, you know, show you point and then they quit pointing. And then you have dogs that do as you did, it was just described in this question, where if they can't get to it, then they'll point. But if they can, you know, all bets are off. And that's probably the most common thing. So what was described in the email, what in the message, was that this dog was had obedience and was force-fetched and was being collar conditioned and is obviously very bold on birds. So I think you referenced the book in there. Switch on over, get on up to, I believe it's chapter 19. Don't hold me to that. I think that's what it is. And that's de-chasing. So when you have in place boldness on birds, they really like them. They understand. I don't mean they're expert and they're highly skilled, but they know when you go out in the upland field that those little guys are out there and they're real excited about looking for them. And when they find one, they're really happy about it, and they may point or not. So anyway, when you get them where they're very bold and you have the tools, and this is real important. This is the part you, it doesn't sound based on your message that you would be skipping this, but it's something that most people skip, the obedience and then the collar conditioning. So if you have a dog who understands that you're the one in charge, and you have the tools to call them and to require that they come to you. So if you read in chapter 19 on the de-chase, and you have bold and you have obedience, and then you collar condition your dog so that they understand this remote enforcement of routine obedience commands. That's all it is. It's not a punishment. I really want to do a podcast on the electric collar because, well, there's some ideas out there that I, for the dogs, wish were not. But it's not a way to punish them. We aren't doing any punishing at all. But we have the tool of obedience enforcement, of electricity, so that we don't have to be directly connected with them. So the next step that you need to do is to de-chase your dog. And I believe I have an entire podcast just on de-chasing because it's very important that it's not teaching the dog to be steady to flush. That's kind of a part of the result of it. But what it does is it removes the chase response from the dog. It removes it. So we don't punish them for wanting to go after the bird, but we remove it through the de-chase process, which takes usually about two times. Two or three birds, about two times, if done correctly, if you understand what you're doing and you have your timing correct on that, then you teach the dog, when that bird comes up, you're done. It's all over. You're just done. And without making them think that it is the bird that is causing the problem, and that is so very important. They aren't being punished for going after the bird. That's why I want you to read that chapter or listen to that podcast where I go into a lot of depth on what it is that you want to be doing. Because you can mess this up and have it, you know, just de-point a dog entirely if you don't understand what you're doing. But once you de-chase that dog, one of several things happens. With a lot of dogs, I love this. There are many times when you take that, if you go pursue it, you get a lot of fun at chasing it. When you remove that, then they stop moving and pursuing the bird. In other words, they don't go bust it up because then they just have to stop and watch it. And so for many, many, many dogs, that sort of makes that point, whether they see it or don't see it, whether they see the bird or don't see the bird, that makes that point a lot of times really, really start to come into, you know, something that is meaningful. And then after that, when you have a good de-chase and you go in there and put in a good woe break, which I've gone over in great detail, now we can, over a period of time, doing it at the time that's appropriate for the dog, you can steady up your dog. And when he's a year old, you can probably have a steady dog on the point. Now, some dogs, this is another thing that happens. Sometimes when you de-chase some dogs, so and they bust a bird and it flies up and they learn when it flies up, you don't get to do anything. And they keep busting up the bird and then just stopping. I've had a number of dogs, not the majority, you know, maybe 10%, maybe sometimes 15, 20% up to that. It, you know, I'll de-chase them because they've shown point, they flash point a little bit. But it's usually more of a flash point, not one that points real well and then can't stand it, bust in there. So they go in and they learn that when the bird comes up, they can't, or runs down the road, they can't go after it. So they just go in there and produce it and stop. So with those, sometimes that happens. And so it's not like you did the de-chase wrong. It's just that you've got a dog that really wants to do what he wants more than he wants to do what you want. Or you have a dog whose obedience isn't very good. And so they want to do what they want more than they want to do what you want. So it still comes down to that. It may be something you've caused by very lackadaisical obedience. Or it may be you just got a real determined dog who doesn't care what you think. And if you do that, if you have those things, it's going to take you a little more time. You're going to have to, you got to have birds that he can't just chase around on the ground. You got to have birds that fly away. And you're going to have to do a very good will breaking. And if you do that, but maybe more important than that, you better have that dog thinking that all the things that you want are the most important thing. Now, I always tell that to people, and they nod, oh, yes, yes. And I don't think they have a clue what I'm saying. But I mean, you have to have that dog where if they just think they heard you say shit or hear or heal or whatever, they are on it. And when you have a high level of sensitivity and response for what you want, then a lot of times that itself will stop those dogs that bust and then don't go after it because they're like, gonna get that last one in on you because they can. That's oftentimes the way to go after that. So that's what you do with dogs, that it's time for de-chasing. If that little dog was 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 months old and didn't have all those training tools and didn't understand the bird game, then no, you would never, ever de-chase them. You have to have, the bold thing is very important. You have to have that. I know people don't like it. I've had people, I get their dog, the dog is 7 months old, we're just starting to, go after birds. They go, you haven't well broken yet, is he? It's like, that's the last thing. There's so much that comes before that. And not just a time or two, got it type thing, but it has to really be in the dog where they're just like, whoa, this is the greatest thing in the world. So that's very important. Okay, and I hope that answers that question. Now, I had another one on a slightly younger puppy. I think actually a fairly new puppy. Somebody had gotten a puppy from a real good breeder, and the dog was making all kinds of noise. And there are some lines of dogs that are noise makers. that's for sure. And people are kind of flummoxed by that. And especially when it's a little guy, if it's a 3-month-old dog or, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, I mean, you're like, this is a puppy. But let me say this about dogs making noise. And I know it's like, well, I don't want to hear a lecture, just tell me how. But when dogs tend to be noisemakers, in my experience, I have found that you need to stop that from the very, very beginning, okay? Not, well, but we'll get this over time. You don't get that over time. You have to teach that little dog that making noise is not part of its thing. Now here's the hard part for people because they want, okay, so tell me how do I do it? What do I need to get? Because if you go on the internet or you go to your puppy training class at the local pet store, and they either have treats or a gimmick thing or something, spray water, whatever. You spray water in the face of a lot of labs, they're going to make more noise because they like that. So I have never found anything. I don't do any kind of tricky things. And I'm sure every now and then they work somewhere. But in general, because I get noisy dogs all the time in for training, and you come to a kennel and then they really feel like, hey, I can make a lot of noise. This is like a zoo here. And it has to be stopped. And it's much, much easier stopped from the very beginning. So two things. If you have your dog, if you put it out in the backyard and the neighbor dogs are running the fence and barking, and you're upset because your dog is barking, I don't think I can help you with that one. Either that or never let your dog in the backyard. Because it's probably spending more time with the neighbor dogs running the fence and learning to make noise. Right? So if you don't like that, don't let that happen. That's the only answer to that. But if you have a dog that you bring it in and you put it to bed, or it's sitting in the, you know, its crate in the house because it's a puppy and you can't trust it yet, and it really sets up a bunch of noise, then it pretty much comes down to this. Let's just take a little trip into the dog world. If this was a litter of wild dog puppies down by the river, right? Wild dog puppies. She just had a litter of puppies. And there are predators around. You know, there's coyotes and things that want to eat those babies and do stuff. Okay, those babies have to be quiet. And mom will make them be quiet. They must learn. There are times where you have to make no noise or you will get eaten. And so the mother dog does whatever it takes to shut that dog up, because that's the only thing that's going to save everybody's life. So usually it's pretty brutal. You know, they bite them and they kind of hurt them. They do stuff to them so that the dog is basically a little bit in shock over what happened and very, very intimidated and is quiet. Now, if they're loony bin crazy, nothing works and they're going to make noise. I can't help you with that. But you have to do things to the dog that the dog does not wish to have happen again. And you have to find what that is with your dog. For some dogs, if you pop the crate or something with a plastic bat or something big, the noise or just the shock of it is enough. With some dogs, and forgive me for all this, people, if you roll the crate over a couple turns, you know, and say, if you're going to bark, I'm going to just flop you through here like you were a hot dog down at the convenience store. And sometimes that works. I wouldn't do the water spray, because water's kind of a cool thing for a retriever. So sometimes with the dog, if I have to, I will literally, this is kind of terrible, I will go in there, fold their ear over so it's two thicknesses, and I will literally bite it a little bit. It hurts. I don't do any damage to the, that's really personal. That's what its mother would do, right? And it's really personal. And they really don't like that. And a lot of times you can make them be quiet, because that's much worse than their desire to make noise. And there's a lot of things that you can come up with. You can't be afraid of, don't do anything that is harmful or cruel. Obviously, I don't need to tell anybody listening to this that. But you have to do something to this dog so that it says, holy cow, I don't want that to happen again. That's the only answer. And sometimes that's not something that you enjoy doing. At very least, if you got a dog that won't be quiet, I literally would do this. I'd put it in the closet, in the basement, shut all the doors and go, you can make all the noise you want, little dog, but it's not going to get you anything. But I prefer myself to address it face to face and go, it's you or me, dog, and it's not me. So you're going to have to be quiet. And it's not pleasant. But you've got to find something. And the littler they are, the younger they are, the easier it is to overwhelm them with stuff and make them think twice. But you get thrown out of events if you have a noise-making dog. The neighbors can't stand you. People don't want to hunt with you. You know, your dog makes noise in the vehicle, the dog makes noise in the house when you're gone, when you're not gone, when a butterfly flies by. So it's really worth stepping far out of your comfort zone and doing whatever it takes to make that dog go, you know, I'll just be quiet over here. One of the ways that I use when I have a little puppy is if I have an older dog around that's calm and, you know, used to sitting in the kennel during the day and enjoying the world, I will put that puppy, not right next to him, but one kennel down. And they learn from that older dog, hey, man, nothing's going on, you snooze. And you don't bark. And when people walk up or drive up, you don't make any noise. So a quiet older dog, not side by side touching, but adjacent to this animal, is very helpful at teaching them what good behaviors are. And I've got a whole series of real famous dogs that I've had in here that learn from an older dog to just kind of hang out and be cool and don't bark. I mean, we can drive up, get out, go in the house, come out, go down in the kennel, and they're just waiting, and they don't make a sound. And the older dog has taught them that, and that's what they do. So just do whatever it takes, even if it's real uncomfortable. But if you're going to use little things that the dog finds mildly annoying or even amusing, like spraying it with something or shaking a noisy thing at it, then it's just going to build up a greater and greater resistance to what you're trying to prevent. So let's be a little bit careful with that one. And then I had another question. I'm not going to make this thing be too long, but I had another question about how do you decide what level to start running dogs? You know, should I start at the beginning and work my way up? Should I not? Where should I go in the middle of things? And I guess for some people, especially if you're kind of new and you're doing this the first time, and of course you're getting advice from every which way, and basically what everyone is going to tell you to do is whatever it is they did. It's like, oh, I did this, it was great, this is what you need to do. So I'm going to just throw some ideas out for people who maybe want to go work with their dogs and run some, some dog events, and all of them, whether, and I'm not going to talk about field trial stuff, but I'm going to talk about more of the hunt test related things, and even the run and guns, and what's out there. So you have the HRC stuff, the United Kennel Club sponsored bunch of hunting dog activities, and they have several levels, right? And they have this big point system. So they have started and seasoned and finished. So you have the little crazy dogs, the young dogs that are just doing singles, and you can hold on to them. And then you kind of have the middle thing where they can handle and they can do multiple marks. They can do that stuff. And then you have the higher level where they're steady, and there's a lot of control, and they can do a lot of marks and blinds and kind of trickier stuff where it shows a lot of control and a lot of savvy. And the same thing over in AKC, junior, senior, master. Each one demands a little bit more of the dog and of the handler. And then you have, the American Pointing Lab Association. So they have certified, advanced, and master. Same thing. Each one demands a little bit more. In all of these, for one, you make sure you understand they're all different. There's some upland in the HRC. There's always upland in the American Pointing Lab Association, obviously, since they're pointing dogs. And then in AKC, it tends to be just conventional retriever stuff. Land and water, marks and blinds. They have that. So if you're trying to decide where you want to start and what you might want to do, I would suggest that you go first to some of the events and manage, if you can, to at least see at least a little bit of each of the three stakes that they have. And don't watch one dog. I mean, you may be seeing the most finished, an 8-year-old dog that's starting at the beginning that just makes it look like nothing. Or you may be seeing an untrained dog that doesn't belong there at all and not really good to get a good idea. So try to go and look at all of them if you can. If you're interested in the pointing stuff, go look at an APLA thing if you have a test close by. There's videos. I think the Northwest Pointing Lab Club puts out videos of some of the tests and what some of the dogs do. And AKC and HRC things are all over the place. Go and watch those. My only commentary in terms of making a choice, it's if you're a brand new person and you've never done this before, then it makes sense to start at the beginning. It makes sense. I think in APLA, you have to start at the beginning. You have to certify your dog before you, but the next day you can go on to the next thing, I believe. But when you go watch the beginning things where it's just single marks on land and on water, and you can hold the dog, and it's the same thing in APLA, single marks on water, and then you have upland and you have to do the land retrieves there. But when you're holding on to them, and in AKC there's literally a shot bird called a flyer, right? They have that, and you're holding on to the dog, and then, you let them go, and they go, and they get real crazy. They get real wound up, a lot of them, not all of them. Some of them are just calm and nice. And a lot of them get real wound up. And so after you pass the four necessary, four unique separate tests, your dog thinks that a hunt test is the wildest, craziest, most fun thing in the world. So if you're new to this and you want to get your feet wet, that's not a bad place to start. But then you wind up with a dog that is a little half nuts. And so then you have to kind of go back before you move on to the next step where they do have to be steady. And you got to kind of undo some of the things that you were taught that they've learned, you know, being held on to and restrained physically and being wild and crazy. So the next level where you begin to introduce the more advanced things, you know, the steadiness and multiple marks and maybe a little bit of handling. I would, for anybody that's relatively new, that's a great place to, don't just jump all the way to the end. Not because necessarily your dog can't do, maybe your dog, you've had help or your dog's been trained by somebody and it can run the highest level, but you don't know how. That doesn't work. If you listen to my just prior podcast to this one, where there the thing between you and your dog is real important, and you have to know what the dog knows, and you have to be able to communicate really clearly with it. So before you jump into the big stuff, I strongly suggest that people kind of start in the middle stuff, so that the started or the senior hunter, so that they can learn, you know, with a little bit more leeway in the rules and a little bit, you know, you're maybe allowed a control break or you can talk to the dog. You can, there's some things where you can kind of help yourself and learn on a simpler set of marks and maybe a simpler kind of blind. Not always, man. I've run some stuff that's ridiculous hard. You know, I don't think that was appropriate, but generally it's something that's a good thing to get your feet wet into learning how to handle this stuff. Because I would say, no matter, again, like in my prior podcast, where people go, oh, that looks so easy, you run a dog on this stuff. Just walk up, sit down, signal forward, stuff goes down, you send them. That doesn't look too hard. It's really hard. It's really, there's a tremendous amount of skill and communication involved in that. And so make no assumptions when you just go watch. I remember one time years ago, a guy that was new to the dog world, and we went to the National Amateur Field Trial in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and we went up there, and they had this big quad on this river bottom. Just a big monster thing. That's the year Jemima Supercake won the National Amateur. But she used to travel around in a little car with ducks in the back with duct tape on them. But the guy that was there with us, a young fella, and he watched that and he goes, this is not hard at all. I could do this. That's what I just remember thinking. I don't know a lot, but I'm pretty sure that's not true. It's just funny because the dogs are so good and things look so easy. It's not easy. And it's not easy to get them to look that accomplished. There's a lot of work that went into it. So for anyone looking to decide, if you need to, you know, if your dog isn't very trained and you just want to see if you like it, then start in those beginning things. Those are a lot of fun. Get the titles. Understand your dog's going to get really, really wound up in that stuff. And then you're going to have to really train quite a bit to get them really back under control. But when you start at that next level, and learn about the mechanics of a hunt test and what it feels like to have the judge behind you telling you what to do and to have to work cooperatively with another handler and another dog for honoring and the stuff that goes on with that. And what it's like to have all that happen and you have no control over your dog other than they just have to do what you say. And how do you handle and how do you run a blind that's close to a mark? Have you trained on that? How should I train to do this stuff? Go ahead and if you can, start in the middle. You know, maybe you're just gifted and you can jump into the high stuff. But it's a real good thing to just kind of get your feet wet on that middle level. And then if you like it, you know, I'm going, this is a lot of fun. I really like this. Then by golly, finish that level and get ready for the next. And after that, you don't have to waste your time on any of the lower levels. You know what it takes and you have the ability. So it's a lot of fun to do these things. But it's not something you can just do over, you know, look at it this week and go, you know, next month I think I'll do it, if you haven't done all of the preparation on that. So that's my advice on that. If you're brand new and just need to see if you like it, try that new stuff. But boy, does it have some downside effects on your dog. And jump into the middle part, and that's where the fun really begins. Okay, and for my last listener question, Not going to make this go on too long. I had one that was actually based on the prior podcast where I talked about communication and my opinion about what this was all about. And the response, basically, I'm just going to kind of just sum it up. The response was, you know, I don't agree with what you said at all. My goal is to win every training session I'm in, to win every hunt test I run, to be the best one there always, to do the very best job. That's my goal, and I think that's the way to approach this, to win every training session. And so very strongly I felt that way and thought that maybe I was just being, you know, a little bit too contemporary, too nicey-nice about everything where everybody gets a finished ribbon. No, that would not be me. But I understand that perspective, and I understand where someone is coming from when they say that, because, in fact, most of us who compete would like to do the very, very best job we could, and it would be awesome if that was just better than everybody else's. But in the end, that's not what it's all about. Really, that's not what it's all about. I'm going to assume that the individual from the other part of the country that wrote that to me was probably fairly young, I would say. Not somebody that's been around a long, long time. Because that is how we're programmed when we're younger, particularly when we're male, I think. We're programmed to, you know, be the warrior and be the big guy. And I understand all that. But I really do want to address that. I really, really do. Because the assumption that what I'm saying is everybody gets a finish ribbon and we all make nice could not be further from the truth. Matter of fact, I'm running an Ironman this weekend, not because I just want to be there with everybody else, because it's freaking hard, and I want to see if, you know, if I can do this, if I can do something that's really hard. And would I like to just beat everybody? Oh, heck yeah, I would. Am I going to? No, because there are some amazing people there that have been doing this a lot longer. But what I want to talk about is what I said is every training session that you do, whether it's by yourself or with other people, in the end, okay, in the end, is not about the outcome of that day or the outcome of that next event that you're going to run. At the moment, at the time, that seems like that's what the most important thing is. But in the end, it is not. Now, I don't know that if I was 24 years old, I would have said this. Maybe I would. Can't remember. Can't remember. But I know now, having done all of this for so long, and, you know, been fairly successful at it for a long time, and found out how you get there and how you actually be the very best that you can be, and oftentimes better than most of the other people, is not by always making them be the goal. Not by making them be the goal. Not by making their work be your standard. I think that that is a mistake. And over time, and if you stay in this long enough, you will stop making other people be your standard and your goal. And you will find your own, where you belong. And where you are, and when you stop making it be under control of other people and defined by other people, now you're going to get somewhere. And I really think that's the point. So, yes, it's nice to have done, you know, have a dog that's really good and learns more rapidly and does things really well. That's really nice. But in the end, again, what, when you look back at this, when the dog that you're training right now, that you're trying to, you know, go out and just be a world beater with, when that dog is gone, you're not going to sit there and go, wow, we had this many ribbons and we were Master National Hall of Fame, or we were the youngest this or that, or look at my wall over here. I have 75 ribbons and this many points and a jacket and these trophies. That's not going to be it. That's going to be cool. It's going to get real dusty. But what's going to matter are the hours that you guys spent together and the growth that occurred between you guys, between the two of you, two gals, two whatever, whoever it is, the growth and the progress and the expansion as a team and you as a human. That is what is going to stay with you. When you look back at the dog that's gone, and you remember the way he looked at you that one time you went duck hunting, or you remember the way he looked at you, you know, before he finished the Master National for the sixth time, or you looked at the way he looked at you, you know, before he took his last breath. That's the stuff that matters. The relationship you had, the team effort, the working together, the growth and expansion as two living things that occurred because the two of you worked really hard together. That is the stuff that matters. And if both of you are good enough that you can win the stuff, and you can pass all of the hunt tests and never fail, and you can do all the grandiose things that right now you define as success. If you guys are good enough, that's awesome. That's really great. But that's not what's going to carry you, and that's not what you're going to remember. So whatever your talent level is, and whatever your dog's talent level is, if the two of you together take that as and build and build and build. And sometimes when you're both working in the same direction and you guys each bring four bricks to this wall, you can build a 20-brick wall out of those four bricks. If the chemistry is right between the two of you, you can be greater than you should be. I've seen that a lot because of the thing between the two of you and the importance, and that the significance isn't, listen, dog, make me look good to these other people. Listen, dog, you need to be as good as old Fang over there that Fred owns. You've got to do that. When you take that baloney out of it and you two do the very best you can, there is nobody else's standard. It's just you two getting better and better and better together all the time. One, you're going to be a lot better than you ever would any other way. And two, you're going to remember that, and you're going to be better for that forever. And that will impact the next dog you get and the next dog you get and make things better for them, for those other dogs, and for your teamwork. And so you can want to win all the stuff you want and be better than everybody else. But again, now other people's standards and other people's performances and other people's opinions are defining you. Not fair to your dog. And you know it's not very good for you either. But if you go that other way and let's say this dog is gone, you know, he died. And now you're looking back and you've got, what do you want to look back on? All the ribbons hanging on the wall or the stuff that happened between the two of you that made you guys become more than you would have been without each other? That made, this can sound silly and forgive me, but that made life worth living. That made those early Saturday mornings or those all weekend longs or those long drives or those things where you got up before work real early to go get a little bit of work in. All those things are so worthwhile, and the time you spent together and basically how it improved you as a human and your life experience. That's what this stuff is all about. And when you get that really good, then you get the trappings and you get the ribbons and you get the cool stuff and you get the good performances. And you aren't going to care near much as that as how that dog looks at you when they look you in the eye. So I just want to answer that with that. Because in the end, that's what's going to matter. And if you start with that now when you work with this dog, and you work hard and you do your best, and you do it for a reason greater than the opinion of others or the ribbons handed out by others, you cannot lose. And you will have something that no one else has who doesn't go to that effort. So that's what I have to say about, yeah, I like to win everything and I don't see anything wrong with ego. You know, eventually I hope you do, because then you start to get to the real value of life. So everybody, I've got some questions in there for, I caught up with some of them. There's some others and I'll try to get to them. I'll try to glob some together. But I wanted to get a podcast in before the weekend in case I never show up again. I'm in a ditch somewhere in Boulder, Colorado, or at the bottom of the reservoir or whatever it is. So when I come back from that, we will proceed on training plans for the fall. And for those of you that want to maybe, you know, get a 4X, what's a good training plan? How do you line out the rest of the summer into the fall to go get, you know, some of the things that you and your dog would like to work with? And most of all, what can you do to be, you know, the best trainer that you can possibly be? So that's where we'll head. And I hope this is, you know, I'm sorry for people. It took me a little bit to get to some of these questions. I hope it's useful. And assuming I get through to the other side, I will be back and talk to all of you soon.